Well, we have come to this topic today, which in many ways I hope you appreciate is more weighty because of the circumstances. It's actually been important to appreciate that we don't just do this out of interest, out of kind of a hobby. There are very serious issues at stake. It's been intriguing to me that this topic was so high on the response. You remember we did the survey, we went out, we asked people which topics would they love to see preached on. This was the in the top four that people wanted to hear, the Bible in 30 minutes. When I first heard that people were keen on this topic, you know, not church people, but people outside of church and so on this topic, and you may be here today because of this particular thing. And when I first heard that people were interested in looking at this topic, I thought, awesome, it's one of those very positive things of, look, I just want to know what the Bible's got to say, and I love it kind of packaged quickly. But since seeing that sign as I drive past each day, do you find yourself looking at that sign every time you drive past? I find myself hearing it more as a challenge. The whole Bible in 30 minutes. Let's see you do it. You know, we're like Sydney to back in 30 minutes. Yeah, let's see you do it. Well, I'm here to say I'm going to fail. So I just put it out there right away. So as I said last week, it's the whole Bible in 30-ish minutes is really the way it should be expressed. There's much to do, much to say. I'm going to go through it in two parts today. The first part much quicker than the second part. The first part is what the Bible is. What is it? The second part, what does it say? What's its message? I think they're the two things that we need to know if to get a handle on the Bible. Let me tell you what the Bible is. Firstly to say, it is the best-selling book of all time. Better than any other religious book, better than any other book. It's the best-selling book year on year and continues to be. Now, that's not just me saying that. That comes from a document, The New Yorker. It's by a massive margin, the bestseller year on year. But what is it? Well, it isn't really a book, although that's the meaning of the word Bible. Bible just means, it comes from the Greek biblia, it just means the Greek word for book. It's the book of books, you see. It's just, that's what Bible means. But it's not one book, it's a collection of books, and I'll give you a bunch of stats here. In the Bible, between the folders of this thing called the Bible, there are 66 books. Written over 1,500 years by 40 authors, three different languages, so Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, three continents, but it's got one unified story that I'm going to take you through shortly. It is a massive kind of book with different kinds of genres of writing. Go to the next slide there. Genre just means style. You've got historical narratives, you've got proverbs, you've got poetry, prophecy, letters, law, wisdom. You've got all kinds of different kinds of writing that run through it. And here's the big thing. It is unique of all religious books. So I want to suggest to you, you've got all the religions of the world with their sacred documents, and you've got the Bible. And the Bible stands alone. And that's, again, not just he's a Christian, he's got to say that. Let me give you four things within which it's unique. The first one, it's unique because it does have very many different kinds of writing with many different authors over such an extended period of time. The Quran, just to compare it to the Islamic sacred writings, the Quran is one author at one time, and it's all the same kind of writing. It's him telling you what God says, just in statements. Whereas the Bible is vastly different to that. It's very different kinds of writings there. It's unique. It's unique because it's testable. Again, use the Quran by comparison. The Quran is, Muhammad claims to have had a word from God, and he's telling you what God says. Now, how do you know if that's true or not? How do you know if it really is God speaking? He says it is. Many people believe it is, and just to be as fair as possible, it could be. But how would you know? How could you test it? Well, you can't test it, except perhaps an internal consistency test, but you can't test it. That's the same of all religious books. They're a subjective expression of people's thoughts. They may or may not be right. I'm convinced they're not, but they may or may not be right, untestable. On the other hand, the Bible, with one other religious text, I'll tell you about that in a second, the Bible sits uniquely as not just a book with humans' thoughts about what God thinks. It's actually a book that says that God enters human history. and does things in history. Actually, I'll give you the preeminent one. The birth of God into our world as a man, his death and then resurrection, recorded for us in the New Testament. There is a claim that God enters human history and does something in time and space. Raises his son from the dead. Now that is a wild claim. No other religion makes that kind of claim. It is a wild claim that you are now able to prove is false. How would you prove the Bible's wrong, given that claim? All you've got to do is dig up in the Palestine, Jerusalem area, what? The body of Jesus. If you can dig up, if we found the body of Jesus, the Bible is wrong. What you have here is a God who puts it out there and says, test me. I'm not just going to tell you thoughts that you can't test. I'm going to actually act in history so that you can know I'm true. Now, there's one other book like that in the religious world. It's the book of... Does anyone know? It's the Book of Mormon. It's the Book of Mormon, which claims evidence of God acting in certain events in history in Central America with the Israelites who were meant to have gone there and so on and so on. The difference between the Bible and the Book of Mormon is the Book of Mormon does not have one shred of corroborating, supporting evidence historically for its claims. It's just a complete blank in the history of that nothing. No archaeological evidence, not one piece. It's just someone says these things happen. Whereas the Bible, at many, many points you can test and confirm that these events actually happened. It really is unique and a standout. It's unique further to this because it has a major structural division. If you look at this, you'll see it goes from old to new. I want to take you through that in a little bit further. Again, religious texts of other religions don't have this movement of developing ideas, whereas the Bible has this very stark division between an old and a new. And it's profoundly important to grasp that about the Bible. And I'll take you through that in a moment. It's unique further to this because of the content that fills each of those parts of the Bible. And I will take you through this in more extended length. All of this is what gives the Bible its power. That's why it's the bestseller. That's why it has changed lives all around the world. It's a bestseller because the variety, the length of time over which the authors wrote, the number of different authors, and despite all of this, there is one message. It's impossible to have contrived the message that it has by collusion with its... It is really weirdly miraculous. And it's a powerful confirmation of what it claims to be a word from God to us. There is what the Bible is. Let me take you through what it says. What's its message? The unfolding message. I'd be interested in, many of you have been around a while, and I'd be interested if you ever sat down to actually explain what the Bible's message is, how you would do it. Here's how I'm going to do it, and I dare say most of you are going to go, oh, I would have added that. Let me give it to you in 7 steps. You ready for this? 7 steps. We have a 7-point sermon. And what I'm going to do is move from the first book of the Bible to the last. Okay? 66 books of them. Let's start at Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. The first step is creation. Let me unpack creation and what the Bible says about it. Verse 1. In the beginning, God. You've got to stop there. In the beginning, God. The very great thing the Bible begins with is the truth, the foundational truth of the existence in the beginning of God. Before all else, God. Forever, God. It's striking, it's the claim of the first book of the book, that before all else, there was God. And, verse 1, that God creates the heavens and the earth. He's the one who makes all things out of nothing. Creation ex nihilo, if you've heard that phrase before. We are here not because of some cosmic accident. We are here because of a personal being who wanted us to exist. And the implications of that first sentence are massive. We are not on our own. We are not in a cold, empty universe that will have heat decay and disappear one day. We are in a universe because of a personal being who wanted us to exist. The implications of that are massive. We therefore have an obligation to that God who made us, who is properly over us. We owe him our life, our existence, our breath, our everything, because he put us here. In fact, this chapter, the very first chapter, spells out the creation of humanity in verse 27. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created them. And just a quick side note, the Bible's often been accused of being patriarchal, being down on women and so on and so forth. That's said by people who have not read their Bibles. Chapter 1, verse 27, at the very beginning of this so-called man and female, male and female, he created them equally in the image of God, together to be his image bearers, which again is an extraordinary statement. We are unique in all the creation. You and I, us, humans, are not just animals. We are animal-like, of course, but we have something extra. We are animals that are made in the image of God. We are unique, and that's our experience. Our sense of who we are is undeniably the fact that we are somehow different. There is something about us that stands apart. So a killer whale doesn't get hauled before the courts to be charged with murder. I mean, his name's Killer. You'd think you'd put him in prison. But no, we rejoice in how wonderful nature is. But a human who lives their life killing, we put them in prison. Do you see the difference? There's something different about us. We are unique. We've been made special. We've been made in his image, male and female together. And we've been made like this in his image for relationship. You know, it's interesting, the first couple of chapters of the Bible, and you can see we've only got 65 left to go, right? So we're moving through. You can see how we're getting there, verse 27 at the moment. But the first couple of chapters of the Bible, they have this extraordinary picture about the wonder of God. Let me explain this. What the Bible tells you is that God isn't cool and aloof and distant, but generous, giving, warm, and relational. You know, he could have made creation in all kinds of ways. He could have made it so that we only saw black and white, no colours. He could have made it such that every bit of food we ate tasted like dry Weet-Bix. He could have done that. You know, it sustained you, and he could have made us his slaves, but he didn't. He built colour into the universe and taste and beauty because he's a God who wanted to fill the earth that we might enjoy it. And he's a God that made us not as his slaves, servants, yes, under him rightly, yes, but he made us for relationship with him, friendship with him. Chapter 3, verse 8. We're now up to chapter 3 of the Bible. Chapter 3, verse 8 has a reference there to the fact that the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. Now, they hid from him. We'll come to that in a moment. But they heard him walking in the garden. Now, you mustn't imagine God's got legs. And so there's obviously a challenge here to think about what the language is referring exactly to. But you get the same language in Leviticus 26 of God with his tabernacle being among his people, walking with them. So there's clearly something more going on here than simply saying he's got legs. But the point there is undoubtedly that the Bible is telling us that God is with his people. He wants to be with his people and relate to his people and enjoy his people, and they enjoy him because he's not cool, aloof, and distant. He wants us to be with him. There is the first step in the Bible that is undergirds the whole account. It's the foundation. It's the thing that establishes all, which gives us a decision to make right at the beginning. Is it true? Are we just an accident with no meaning, purpose in our existence? Or are we here because of the purposeful decision of a creator God who made us for him? Which is it? Massively important issue to wrestle with. Let me take you to the next step, the Bible in its message. The next step is tragedy. It's the fall. And it comes in chapter 3. So we're now up to chapter 3 of the first book of the Bible. Chapter 3 tells us about what is known as the fall. It's a fall from the heights of beauty, glory, and greatness, such that the perfection of God's creation and the perfection of God's image bearers are all shattered. It happens because of human disobedience, out of pride or arrogance. Humans disobeyed God. God only gave us one command to begin with. He said, you can eat anything you like. You don't even have to come back and pray to me and say, which thing should I eat today? Just go for it. Enjoy your freedom. But there's one tree you ought not eat from. It's the tree which has the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. Do not eat that one, which is the one they ate. That's the one, it wasn't an apple. And that first act of disobedience changed humanity forever. It changed all their relationships forever. And it changed the universe we live in forever. For the age. It's an extraordinary thing that happened, that we did. They were told by a cunning serpent who personifies Satan, an evil presence who tempts them to believe that if they eat this fruit, it'll all be good for them. They'll become like God and they'll know good and evil. And God doesn't want you to be like him. That's why he's stopping you. And he were tempted and believed, and he disobeyed and rebelled, and they ate, and then everything was broken. Now, what was it that they did? What was going on? What was it to eat the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? I suggest to you, it's not just by eating that they now have a knowledge of what good and evil is. That's not what the word means, knowledge. It's not just they knew what good and evil was before that. You eat that, evil. Don't eat it, good. They knew. How is it they become like God? Well, by eating the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, they themselves, the word knowledge actually has the implication of determination. To know is to determine. They become determiners for themselves of what good and evil will be. God says it's evil to do that, but we will work out for ourselves what good and evil is, and we've decided that it's good to eat it. Do you see how they've now become like God? God is on the throne determining what right, wrong will be, and we've said, no thanks, we'll be the ones who determine what good and evil is, because we know almost nothing, but think we do. And so in their pride, they set themselves up in independence from God, opposition to God, rebellion to God, and there is the essence of sin. And it changes everything. Their relationship to God is smashed. They hide from him. Their relationship with each other is smashed. There's now fear and shame towards each other, because if I can determine what good and evil is the way I want, well, you can as well. And I don't know what you're going to determine, whether it'll be good for me or not, because I can't trust you anymore. And so it's all broken. And their relationship to the world is smashed. And the world around them is smashed. And everything is brought down. You know, there are so many who are quick to dismiss these early chapters of the Bible as unscientific and myth. But what it has in the midst of many other truths is a deep insight into human nature and the reality that we exist in. Every human is now born east of Eden, in a world that's marred by sin and pride and selfishness and disobedience and rebellion. That's the world we're now born into because of our forebears. And we now live in a world that's fallen, that is now marred by death, by the horror of that great evil. Can I just have a quick comment about funerals? There are three reasons we have funerals. We have funerals to give thanks for the life of a person. But we have funerals to grieve and mourn the loss of a person. And we have funerals to remind ourselves that we live in a world marred by death, and we too will die one day. Have you noticed in the last 30 years, if you've been around long enough, Funerals have changed. The reason we have funerals today is simply to celebrate. Now, why has that shift happened? Because our world doesn't know what to do with the negative thing that death is. And so we just want to come together at the death of a person and celebrate their life and think good things and make positive thoughts about it all, because we don't know what to do with that, Allah. And the history of Christians has been to gather to face the reality of the grief that death is. Karen's loss, we need to grieve it. It is a horror in our world. Death, I was just talking to these guys, that you, it's just such a, you don't know how to process this thing that death is. We will come together to grieve our loss and remind each other that we live in a world where death is our future. We will all die because we live east of Eden, because we live in the fall that we brought on ourselves. There's the first two steps. The third step is this, and it's absolutely surprising. And the true glory of the message of the Bible is that in the midst of God's right judgments on our pride and sin, he brings rescue. Have a look at chapter 3, verse 15. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. Let me explain that verse to you. It's a verse that comes in the context of God pronouncing judgment on the tempter, the one who's actually tempted the humans to go this path. He says, I'm bringing judgment. I'm angry. But in the midst of his judgment upon him, he says these words. He says, I'm going to bring a child from the woman who will crush you, who will bring judgment, destroy you. You will strike his heel. You will harm the child of the woman as he does that, but he will crush you and destroy you, the enemy. He'll defeat Satan. Now, what is that verse? Written by an author 1,400 years before Jesus, who never knew of Jesus in the flesh personally. But what you have here buried at the very beginning of the Bible is a promise from the God who's hurt and offended and angry at the way the humans have treated him and his world. And in the midst of that, the God who should just destroy says, I'm going to bring rescue. I'm going to bring rescue. And that is amazing. Astonishing that it's anticipated so before, and astonishing that it comes from God himself. And it's a promise that runs all the way through the Old Testament. A few chapters later, it's given a little more flesh. You come with me to Genesis chapter 12. See how we're now moving through the Bible. We're getting towards the end. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, the Lord said to Abram, what he does is he calls out one child of Eve. So the seed of Eve, the child of Eve, will one day come and defeat and bring rescue. Well, here's a child of Eve, Abraham. And God says to Abraham, here's the beginning of my plan. And so these fundamental foundational words, and if you've got a pen, underline these. I will make you a great nation, verse 2, I'll bless you, I'll make your name great, you'll be a blessing. I'll bless those who curse you, whoever curses you, I'll curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. 12 chapters into the whole Bible, God has already said he'll bring a rescuer. And he now says to Abram, he says, I'm actually going to use you to bring this rescue so that all the nations of the planet will be blessed again. In chapter 15 of the same book, he actually says it's his seed, the seed of Abraham, a child of Abraham. So we're looking for this rescuer, this child of Abraham, who will bring blessing to all the world. Underline, it's the promise that's given some shape. God is going to reverse the impacts of the fall that we brought on ourselves and his judgment that brought all of these things into our world. God announces his plan to bring life again one day. These things are foundational issues. Creation, the fall, God's promise to rescue us. But they proceed further forward in the Old Testament with two more steps. Let me take you to the fourth step that's revealed in the Bible. It's the evidence of our need for the rescue. The evidence of our need for the rescue. You see, entwined within the repeated comments about rescue to come and a salvation to come is the revelation of how certainly we can't rescue ourselves. So entwined in the context of a rescue to come is this message that we can't rescue ourselves. And it comes in the form of the law of Moses. A law is given through Moses after God rescues the people out of slavery in Egypt. You read this in the second book of the Bible, the book of Exodus. I do promise you it will go much faster soon. But in the book of Exodus, you get mention of Moses and his rescue out of Egypt. But he rescues the people and God brings them to a mountain called Sinai, and he gives them the law. It's a law is an extended work. There's a whole lot of laws that are given, but at the head of them is what we know as the Ten Commandments, called the Ten Words, the Ten Great Words. And the Ten Commandments, you may have heard of them. They're a set of laws that have shaped Western society, actually. They've been massive. You read of them in Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord. You should remember the Sabbath. You should honour your father and mother. You shall not murder. You commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not, and so on. Do not covet. The Ten Commandments, the Ten Great Words. This is massive. This part of them is massive. It gets repeated later in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Moses, the lawgiver, the mediator of this law, it forms the basis of a contract between God and people. You come back with me one chapter, Exodus 19, and you'll see it there expressed. I'm trying to give you a taste in little bits of the Bible as we go through. I hope it doesn't lose us, but I'm trying to give you a sense of the Bible and not just tell you about it. Exodus 19, listen to this contract, verse 5. If you obey me fully and keep my covenant contract, then out of all the nations you will be for me a treasured possession. Though the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Do you hear what God says? He says, I'm going to make an agreement, a covenant. I'm going to make a contract between me and you. And the contract is this. If you do something, I'll do something. If you keep the law, if you obey me like you ought, then I'll be your God. You'll be with me. We'll be back together. Relationship established again. This idea of an agreement is repeated throughout the Bible. You get it in Leviticus 18 verse 5, a very important one because the New Testament's reference back to it. Leviticus 18 verse 5 says that if you keep my decrees and laws, the person who does them will live. The person who keeps my laws will live. My agreement, my contract, my covenant is you keep the law, I'll give you life. And in fact, in Deuteronomy, we're now into the fifth book of the Bible. We're moving much faster. In Deuteronomy chapter 28 and 29, you get God saying through Moses, he says, if you obey me, then all these blessings will come. If you disobey me, then all these curses will come. There's the agreement. Get to it. Obey me. Start living like you ought. Well, things start well. Moses gives them these words, and they as a nation respond and say, we'll do everything God commands. We're in. We want life. We'll obey. The problem, before the ink was dry on the agreement, they failed. And they failed again. And failed again. And so begins a cycle of history for this nation that a large chunk of the Bible is given over to in the Old Testament. And here's where we'll move forward much more quickly. The book of Joshua, sixth book of the Bible. 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, recounts a series of historical events in the history of Israel where they go through this cycle of we want to obey God, we want to live under you, we want to do what's right, and we want to fulfill our part of the agreement so that we can have life with you. And God says, awesome, and then they fail. And he judges them. And they cry out to God in judgment and say, we're sorry, we've blown it, please have us back. And God, the merciful God, says, I'll have you back. Yeah, of course, let's start again. So they determine to start again. And what happens? They disobey God and it fails again. He judges them. And in judgment, they cry out for mercy. God, the merciful God, gives mercy. This happens again and again and again and again. What's the message? What's the message? What emerges from it is a very clear lesson, a couple of clear lessons. First is this. If life with God and being saved by God, being with God, depends on me and my performance, my law keeping, I got no hope. I've got no hope. The history of Israel shows me that they tried. They had the best of help and failed. Best of help, failed. I've got no hope if it depends on me and my law keeping. We're lost. I'll tell you another lesson that comes from it. God is just and merciful. You know, a popular perception of the Bible is that it's all about being a good person. It's about being a law keeper. People drive past churches all the time. I know, I talk to my friends, and they drive past churches and they think to themselves, there's that crowd of people who think they're better than anyone else. It's possible that churches are full of people like that. I hope it's not true here. Because I tell you, I'm not here because I'm better than anyone else. I'm here because I've read this message and realized that I can't be good enough. I'm a complete failure. That's why I'm here. I know I need rescue because I can't do it myself. The deepest message of the Bible is that the law was given to show that we couldn't keep it. The law was given so that we might see how far fallen we are. It was given to underline our need for rescue. Now, where does that leave us? Bound into sin, judgment, and death. So the fifth step. God, having driven that message home through the Old Testament again and again and again, reaffirms his promise to rescue, but he adds more dimensions to it. It fills out more so that you come now, rush all the way forward to Jeremiah 31 and you get these extraordinary words that Dawn read for us. Verse 31, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people. It won't be like the old covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them. It won't be like the one with Moses and the law, where I said, if you keep the law, you'll be with me. It won't be like that one, because that one never worked. And you know why it didn't work? Why didn't it work? Because of us. Because of the perversion of sin within us. We could never keep it. If it depended on us, we were lost. And so God says, I've driven that message home and I'm now going to bring a new agreement. Agreement, verse 34, that will depend on forgiveness. For I will forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more. Further to this, God adds other dimensions. He says in 2 Samuel 7 that this new covenant will come through a king, a great king who will be greater than any king. Who will be my son, a king, who will come as a king, Isaiah 53, to suffer in our place. Now, you know this verse, many of you. If you don't, enjoy this moment. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Ba, ba, do, ba. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Don't do the next bit. There you go. The point being, God begins to develop this rescue plan and inform us of how it will work. It'll come through a king who will suffer and bear on himself the judgment we deserve. This is unique of all the religions. Nothing else like it in the history of religion. That God, who is rightly angry, will come and solve the problem for us and create a new covenant. There's the foundations. Then there's silence for 400 years at the end of the Old Testament. This promise waits for 400 years with not a word from God. Malachi is the last book of the Bible, of the Old Testament, and we wait until Luke chapter 2. Luke chapter 2 records an event that happened in history. Caesar Augustus, verse 1, issues a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world, and everyone goes home to their own town to register. So the great Roman emperor says, you've all got to go back to your hometowns. And a young couple, Joseph and Mary, go back to their hometown, to the town of David, Bethlehem. And what we discover is that behind the emperor of the world is the emperor of the universe, who actually sovereignly causes this event to happen. And so Joseph and Mary go to the town of David, and there they give birth to a child. And you get these wonderful words, chapter 2, verse 10. An angel said to them, do not be afraid. I bring you good news that will cause great joy for all the people, all the earth, all the nations of the earth. Genesis chapter 12, fulfilled. Today in the town of David, a Saviour has been born. He is Messiah, the Lord. He is the great King we've been waiting for. And he will be the suffering King. And so Jesus comes on the scene. And the first four books of the New Testament record the history, eyewitness accounts of the life of that Jesus, so that you can test, you can check, you can actually work out whether it happened or not. So important is that event, because it pulls all of the Old Testament together. And Jesus comes, and have a look right at the end of his life, chapter 22. Flip all the way over to there. You can do this in any of the accounts of Jesus' life, but let me just pick one, Luke's Gospel, Luke's account of his life, Luke 22. The last night of Jesus' life before he goes and becomes crucified, he says these words in verse 20. In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Wow. If you've been following the journey through, when the promise was reaffirmed, it was a promise about a new covenant that would come, a covenant based on forgiveness, a covenant that would have a king come to suffer. And Jesus, just before he's going to his own death, having already said that he comes not to be served but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many, he says, drink this cup, and he says, this is a symbol that my blood shed tomorrow, my death, will inaugurate the new covenant that you've been waiting for. A new agreement between God and humanity, where God says, I will forgive you. Not just by brushing under the carpet your sin, but by having my servant, my son, pay the penalty for you. I will deal with sin justly by judging the perfect one, Jesus, who dies in your place. But by his blood shed, I am now able to agree to forgive you, though you don't deserve it, and bring you life that the law promised but couldn't give because your sin was so profound and perverse. Give you life again back with me, in relationship with me as your Lord, living as your man in relationship with me. The agreement is this. How do you get that? Look to Jesus. Trust Jesus. Put your faith in Jesus. Don't think that your life is good enough. Don't trust in your own righteousness. Look to Jesus and his merits. And my agreement is this. If you look to Jesus, repentant and humbled, recognizing your sin, if you look to Jesus, I'll forgive you. And I'll welcome you home. And you will now no longer die. Though you die, you'll be ushered into eternity with me. Not because you're better than anyone else, but because my son died for you. Forgiven. Do you see how extraordinary this message is? God made us for himself. We rebelled. He promises a rescue and fleshes it out and then shows us how much we need it, that we can't do it ourselves. We can't be good enough. Don't be proud and arrogant to think that you can be good enough, he says again and again and again. And then he shows the rescue that's coming. It's going to come with a new agreement, forgiveness, based on the merits of a Saviour who stands in your place. Look to him, trust him, put your confidence in him, flee to him, and all the promises of the Old Testament will be fulfilled. Last and final step. God promises for all of this to be fully fulfilled, where there'll be a new creation. And that's the last book of the Bible, Revelation, where there'll be no more death, no more mourning, no more grief, where the old order of things will have passed away, all because of what God has done for us, though we don't deserve it. And he holds out this hope. And he says, you can know this is true. You can know I'm going to do this for those of you who are in Jesus. You can know I'm going to do this. Do you know what proves it's true? The resurrection. The resurrection of Jesus. God takes his son who dies and 3 days later raises him to life again and gives public testimony that there is a new creation to come and Jesus is the first fruits of it. So that if you trust in him, you will die to sin and be raised to life with Jesus forever. And he has given us proof by raising his son from the grave. This is a message like no other. It's the most wonderful message. God so loves the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish. Let me pause there and see if there are any questions, and I've got a couple more things to say at the end. How long did I take?
Well, we've got time for a couple of quick questions.
You're meant to say 30 minutes, but you obviously
30 minutes-ish.
30-ish.
All right, so we've had quite a few questions that have been text through. We'll be able to get to some of them. So firstly, some bits of the Bible just seem crazy. Jonah and the whale walking on water makes it hard to believe.
Yeah. So what do you do with the miracles that are talked about in the Bible? They're largely resolved if you're convinced there's a God. The issue really resolves there. That is to say, if there is a God who created the world, and that God is bigger than just setting up the laws of nature to do their own thing. If he's a God who creates the world and sustains every moment of the world's existence, if he is that kind of God that the Bible presents to us, he can have someone walk on water. He can have a fish swallow someone. He can do any of that. So the question really resolves down to, do you believe there's a God? And if you're convinced there's a God, the question isn't, are miracles possible? The question is rather, did these miracles happen? It's a different kind of question. It's not miracles aren't possible. It's rather, okay, the Bible's claiming these particular ones. What are these particular ones about? What are they pointing to? What's the significance of them? That's more the question. So the resurrection of Jesus particularly, God can raise a dead person if he wants. He is God, yeah? If he wants to do it, he can do it. The question is, why did he do it with that man? Well, actually, did he do it with that man and why? They're the more important questions here.
What are the evidences outside of the Bible that backs it up?
Yeah, good. It's kind of a funny question, though a really good question. I'm glad you raised it. But it's outside of the Bible. The point to bear in mind, the Bible isn't one book. The question often has implicit, and you may not have had this in your thinking, but often I get that question with this implicit assumption that you've got one book that says it. What about something else? And I go, no. This is 66 books that just happen to be, for convenience, bound together. So you've got lots of books saying it that were all independent in different contexts. You see, the evidence is much broader than one book. It's like the lawyer bringing to a court case his manila folder of all his evidence and someone saying, you keep taking your evidence from that manila folder. Have you got anything else? And he goes, what are you talking about? All I've done is collate all the evidence. It's here. Well, haven't you got anything more than that manila folder? Do you see? That's kind of a weird thing. Having said that, is there any evidence in other books besides these 66? Yeah. Depends what you want evidence for. The life of Jesus, the events of Jesus' life are confirmed for us in secular writings. So various non-Christian authors in the first century. Josephus talked about Jesus in his histories of the Roman Empire and so on. So there's various writings outside that confirm key events that are recorded for us in the Bible. Yeah.
All right, I might just see if anybody would like to put their hand up and ask a question, maybe in response to one of the questions that have been answered or something else that you haven't had a chance to text through.
Oh, yep,
down the back. Do we have a microphone that can be...
You can shout, go. So that's a comment, not a question. Just to distinguish, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Thank you. Yep.
Why do Catholic Bibles have extra books in them?
Yeah, good question, Sue. There's other books that have been written. So this is a collection of books, 66, but there are other books written. Now, which do you include in the Bible? Which do you include in this manila folder? There was a bunch of books written, you know, I said there was 400 years between the last book in our Old Testament and the New Testament starts with Jesus' birth. There's a bunch of books written through that time, 1 and 2 Maccabees, Tobit, various other books that the Jews wrote. And 1 and 2 Maccabees just record the history of the Maccabean rulers between the intertestamental period. That Jesus and the first century Jews didn't regard them as inspired by God. Now, what happened in the early centuries of the Christian history, as some people began to put this manila folder together, there was a growing tradition to read from 1 and 2 Maccabees, Tobit and so on and so forth. And so they slowly got kind of included in that list. But later on, people recognised that they weren't regarded by the first century Jewish by Jesus as being inspired. And so though good to read, and if you've not read them, they're worth reading. I've read many of them. There are lots of interesting and important things there. They've not been, as a kind of a conservative expression of what really is the inspired word of God, they're not included. There are some other books in the later Christian era that you'll often hear in the kind of Dan Brown Da Vinci Code thing. They're called the Gnostic Gospels, G-N-O-S-T, Gnostic Gospels. The Gnostic Gospels that are paraded as the great alternatives to the Gospels that we have were written two or three centuries later than the four Gospels we've got. And they were claimed the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip, were claimed to be written by Mary and, well, had the name of Mary, but they were long dead. Whereas the Gospel of Matthew was written by Matthew. And when you read those Gnostic Gospels, they're weird. Do you remember New Age lady? Oh, I can see her. Movie. Wrote lots of New Age stuff. No, we've all lost it. They just read weird, and they condemn women and all kinds of strange stuff. Their visions and not historical accounts. They're very different documents. And so the whole thought that they should have been included, the church didn't include them because they... No. The church, what we recognise was the ones that were written by the hands of the apostles, they're the ones we include. They're the ones that are in. Yeah. Shirley MacLaine, that's right. They read like reading a Shirley MacLaine thing. It's just kind of weird. Yeah.
Last question that we have time for. If God created all from nothing and we broke it, why did he need to go through such a dragged out process to fix it?
After all I've said. You can work out the answer to that, can't you? Have you ever hung out with an alcoholic, a drug addict, a porn addict? Do you know how hard it is to move someone off addiction? It's a massive difficulty. The first step in someone coming to deal with addiction, what's the first step? Yeah, whatever you said, I'm sure is right. The first step's realizing you're an addict. Now, that is very difficult to come to terms with for an addict, yes? You know, the reason I drink is because I enjoy drinking and I want to drink. No one's making me do it. No, there's no force. I'm not addicted. I just want to. The reason I smoke is because I want to. Addiction's a really bizarre, weird thing that is hard to come to terms with in the context of being addicted. You can see it from the outside, but inside. Now, we are, says Jesus in John chapter 8, we're addicted to sin. We're addicted to rebellion against God. We're addicted to setting ourselves up to be the determinants of good or in opposition to God. We're addicted to that, and we're in it. We can't see it. Do you know how hard it is to get us to see that's our problem? The whole history of Israel was written to help us see that, because it's very hard for us to see it. It's a massive task to understand yourself because it's so negative. And so why such a convoluted, long, extended because of our problem? Because of how terrible our problem is. And if you can't see it of yourself, here's a bizarre thing. You might be sitting there thinking, well, I don't think I'm an addict. And I look at you and I go, you are. Give me 5 minutes with you. You know, let me talk to your wife. But when you're in it, it's hard for you to see it until you actually get your eyes open to actually see why I keep doing what I ought not do and why I keep doing the things. That's what the whole extended process is. So that when Jesus comes to provide rescue that's dependent not on our performance but on his gift to us, we would be humble enough to realize we need to accept a gift and not simply think we can do it ourselves. That flip is massive. To realize I can only come back to God by a gift, not by my merits. Who do you think you are? Someone with my eyes open. By the grace of God to see how perverse I am. And I've got no hope apart from the gift of God. That's why it's such a long period and why it's so extended. Because we needed all the help we can get. Friends, this leaves us with a choice. It leaves us with a choice. God comes to give us life, but you've got to recognize our need for the gift. And so humble yourself and say, please help me. That's hard to do if you're a proud person. But I tell you, that's the shape of Christianity. Humbled people who recognize we've got nothing to give except what God has given us. So please, if you've been here in church a long time and you still feel proud about it and you think you're better, you need to appreciate what God is saying. It's very different. Come to Jesus and find life. How about I pray? Heavenly Father, we do ask, please, that you might bring us to see the truth about ourselves, humbling though it is, that you might, please, help us see our desperate need in a world that's so fallen and broken. It's full of grief. We're insulated, but please break in and show us our need. And thank you for the extraordinary gift you've given us in Jesus, that you have not left us to our disaster, but you have pursued us and pursued us. And you have sent your Son and given many evidences and a vast literature and many impactful miracles. You've given all of this to help us see the truth, the reality of all that Jesus is. Please help us see these things and be drawn, therefore, to receive the gift that you have for us, a gift of life, return to relationship with you, that we might be forgiven, that we might now no longer die and have a hope beyond the grave. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.